Hi, this is Dan Siegel, author of the book Aware and the book Mind and the Developing Mind, and you're listening to The Soul of Life.
I'm Keith Miller. I bring together people who are interested in slowing down to understand how the mind works and how we can live in greater connection to one another in a fast-paced, stressful world. This is The Soul of Life. Hey, welcome back to The Soul of Life. I'm Keith Miller. When you were a kid, do you remember reading those Choose Your Own Adventure books where, you know, you have a choice to make and then you go one way and the book continues, you go another way and the story changes dramatically and maybe it comes to a quick end? Well, I'm interviewing today a guy named Levi. He doesn't give his full name out, actually, because he created this amazing tool in one corner of the internet called the Integral Guide. And it's a guide to healing and self-help and concepts that are related to mental health and a healthy mind. And this is Levi's first public interview talking about this. He really stays behind the scenes and he's giving us a tour today of this incredible tool that's become very popular on the internet. He started this with a post to a Reddit subgroup on trauma recovery. And pretty soon that post, which included a link to the guide, became the second or third most upvoted post in that subreddit's history. The guide itself averages between 16 and 18,000 unique readers each month and consists of about 1,300 pages. But you get to choose your own adventure as you're reading through and graphically look at how these concepts are connected. It's really hard to explain. It's easier to see it about a third of the way through the interview. If you're able to watch on YouTube, you'll get a screen share of what I'm looking at, and you can go to the guide yourself. It's free. In fact, one of the issues that Levi addresses, and we talk about this, is that a lot of good help for mental health is behind a paywall, where you have to pay a professional for their services to get it. And that really ticked him off when he was going through this, and he just put his heart and soul into this and created a tremendous resource that can really open up new energy for, I think, exploring what's going on inside yourself, relationships, and with emotions. So I hope you enjoy the Integral Guide and my interview with Levi. So Levi, really glad that you're on The Soul of Life with me talking about the Integral Guide, something you've created and put a lot of time and passion into, and something that I can't remember how I stumbled upon it. If you reached out to me, and I can't remember what it was, I know we've tried to collaborate on some things. But I'm really interested, especially to jump into this idea that I think you address in the guide. And we're going to talk about what the Integral Guide is, how it could be helpful for people going through healing in some psychological or emotional way. But, you know, as a point of reference, so I'm a professional that charges money for healing services, and I don't take insurance. So I kind of feel like I'm part of the problem that you're trying to solve with the Integral Guide. I wonder if you can speak to that.
Yeah, so that was one of the catalyzing problems that inspired its creation in the first place, was that I had a therapist at the time that it was being made, but at the same time, I also felt like I was in such a dire situation and I was at a point to where I couldn't really pay for these services myself. And I thought, well, the people who need the most help are going to more often than not have the least amount of buying power. And if that's true, then that means the people who have no money whatsoever and are going to be needing the most help have none or very little. My idea was that I might be in a position to where I don't have access to any of these things at all. And so I wanted to create a kind of safety net for myself so that if I ever had to go without a therapist and while I was learning everything that I was learning, I had something in place to help me navigate those waters. As far as being a part of the problem, I definitely have parts who feel different ways about this. But in general, my attitude is more like, it's not so much that you're part of the problem as much as it is that you and I are both in this problem together. And there's only so much that any one person can do about it because it's a systemic problem and not something that anyone has any one or, you know, more or less responsibility for. It's just a matter of, are we behaving in a way, are we being generous in a way that acknowledges the fundamental worth that a human being has or not? Societally, systemically, we're not, but individually, we can do something to indicate that more, because it's really easy to tell a client, oh, you deserve help, you deserve healing, you deserve all these things. But if our culture isn't demonstrating that, then that's just a platitude. It's just something we're saying to make somebody feel better, which of course makes them feel worse because they can see that. So the guide was kind of a demonstration of that, just not only for myself, but for people who might need it.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You described the guide, and by the way, it's integralguide.com. You can look this up right now, integralguide.com. And I encourage people to take a look at it as you're listening to this. We'll spend a little time, maybe if you can give me a bit of a tour of it. But what you're referencing in what you just said is, it sounds like access to healthcare, access to care in general. And we have an epidemic of mental health right now, an epidemic of mental illness in our country, and it's just not available. I mean, I spent 7 years as a social worker. That's one of the reasons I went into social work, to at least think of myself as being available to everyone. And the focus on social work is advocacy and diversity and inclusion. And but as soon as anybody can graduate from working in public places, public mental health, people, at least my decision was, I got to make a living and pay for, you know, raise a family and that sort of thing. And so it led to the position of being now in with my colleagues, like working with the worried well, right? So you mentioned you were dismayed and angry that those resources were not available.
I mean, there's still anger about it, where it's like, on one hand, I'm really happy to have been someone who had the opportunity to make something that's been valuable to a lot of people now. And at the same time, there's anger around the fact that I had to do it in the first place, that it wasn't available for me when I needed it, and that I'm still having to juggle just human stuff, like just being a human being in the world under capitalism, and at the same time trying to keep this thing going.
Yeah, and you and I were talking a little bit before about wanting, you know, this relationship to your work here, which I have a lot to unpack, and I'm still unpacking in my healing journey, my relationship to my work, how much of my identity is in my work. You prefer to not list your last name on the guide, and it sounds like for important reasons to keep that separate. Is that right?
Yeah. There are several reasons, and I've written about a lot of those. I have a newsletter if somebody wants to go and read the second year anniversary newsletter for the guide. There's more information on that. But generally, the one that I'm sort of like sitting on right now is that the guide isn't really about me. It was something I made for me, and it's informed by my experiences, my own needs. But I didn't publish it because I wanted to have, you know, my name out there and circulating, having written this thing and to be like a person in the field. That was never an aspiration. The only reason it exists is because I needed it. The only reason it's published is because I thought other people could use it. And so one concern that was, you know, sort of is still at the top of the list is that I didn't want me to be at center. I would rather be in the background of it and only kind of come up when I really need to. But otherwise, I want the material there to be what the primary focus is.
I sort of wish that would be the requirement of anyone developing a model of psychology or therapy, because it seems like when there's this sort of founder, I don't know what we'd call it, this sort of, I don't know if it's pathology per se, and I want to get into Stephen Porges and polyvagal, which you talk about on the guide, because there's, you know, once you cross the line and you start promoting your technique, ethically there are professional guides for us to make sure we don't promise something that we promise a cure, right? For example, But that line is really blurry, I would say. Let me ask you to describe, if someone on the street wanted to know, what is the guide? You know, can you distill that in like a couple of sentences?
I've been trying to do this over and over again since it was first published. More or less, I kind of give a something of a recitation of what the homepage says, which is a sort of a choose-your-own-adventure field guide for trauma recovery and general well-being that I started making for myself. And I often describe it as something of a personal wiki of mine, just something that I put together that started as a collection of notes that I was just building so that I could remember things without having to getting triggered over and over again by the material that I was reading. And I rewrote it and contextualized it in a way that made sense to me. And it was sort of like building my own jigsaw puzzle that over time just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And now it's just a resource that I published to the internet.
How many pages does it have? Or do you even know?
The last time I checked, and it's been some months now, is it was about 1,300 pages. And I can't remember whether that includes pages on individual books or not. I might have excluded it. But it's something in the ballpark of 230,000 words, excluding the pages on books and the like.
Wow. It's very impressive. We're going to talk about the interactive graph in a moment because I have some questions about that. But am I correct that maybe in an earlier version, IFS, Internal Family Systems, was actually the hub or the center of the graph, and you were building connections from that model? Or did I maybe just open up to one particular part of the web or the graph and just see IFS as the center? I couldn't quite find it again in that way that I had seen it a few weeks ago.
It's mostly the latter. That graph sort of like self-populates as you navigate the guide. But conceptually, it's kind of true in that I really started getting a handle on what was going on inside and what to do about it because I was learning so much about IFS. It got to the point where other modalities, other like methodologies, meditation practices, I'll just call them practices generally. That's my preferred name. Them working or not working suddenly made a lot more sense through a parts work lens. And then it got a lot easier for me to say, oh, that's why that didn't work the way it was supposed to. That's why I got triggered whenever it was supposed to actually help me. And whenever I sort of reframed that, it allowed me to get a better sense of when to use what and how I can supplement one thing with another. But IFS, you could call it its foundation, at least for a while. Now I would say it's one of its main pillars.
Yeah, I can see just going through the guidebook essentials, you have a lot of basic, you know, internal family systems is listed, for example, next to household maintenance, and that's listed next to emotions and community. So there is in some ways a catch-all of things, nutrition, life curation, outdoors, rest and restoration. These are all categories. And as you click through them, it opens pages that people can see you've described that particular concept, and then you link out to it. Like you said, it's a wiki. It links out to other resources, a lot of external links. How many external links would you?
Oh, I have no idea.
It's a lot.
There's much more internal links than external.
Good point. And that's, I don't know what, how would we tell people, like if they wanted to see the entire graph, is it possible to see it that way from the top?
Yes, there is. I'm not looking at the guide right now, but if you were to just mouse over the graph on the right-hand side, there should be two little icons on the top right-hand corner. One of those should just show you the full graph.
Okay. Global graph?
Yeah.
Global graph. Okay. So I'm going to put this up on the screen for people who are able to watch this on YouTube. This global graph, when it populates, when it opens, I mean, it reminds me of like the Hubble Space Telescope or now the James Webb Space Telescope pictures, because you now see like, whoa, we didn't, all these stars, all this information is right on top of each other. These stars are, you know, coming at us from so many different angles. And when it's like a deep field view of all the concepts that you found relevant for growth and personal and spiritual development. So as you pick something like one of the big stars, each concept has a either a square or a circle or a key or an icon next to it. So like at the center, pretty much at the center, it's compassion. And if you hover over that, you get this really cool image as though you're looking through, it looks like an eclipse of that star, because then you just see these rays of light, which are actually connection points to other systems, other concepts. Like compassion is connected to, it's going through everyday mindfulness for OCD. It's going through radical self-forgiveness. It's going to embrace the possible. It's going to, and these are all concepts, self-energy, equanimity.
Well, some of those are concepts and some of those are book titles.
Oh, gotcha. Book titles. Yep. Yeah. How do you distinguish between the book title?
Any resource, whether it's a book or a video or something like that, will have a sort of book icon in its title. And if you were to mouse over any one of those things, you can see where it's connected through the rest of the guide.
Very, very cool. Where did you get the inspiration for doing this? Are there parallels in other systems, information, disciplines?
Well, the graph itself is a part of the software that I use to build the guide. It's called Obsidian. It just does that all on its own. And I don't use it as often as I used to, because as the graph gets bigger and bigger, it actually becomes, for me, a little bit less useful. But it's fascinating to just mouse over and see where things are interconnecting. But as far as like how the guide is constructed, its structure just sort of emerged as I continued playing around with it. You know, there are some notes that are structured very differently than other ones. And some of that is habit. Some of it is just what shape the particular note took. And so, for instance, with those resource notes, any of those books, I would just copy and paste the description from whatever website and then start tagging concepts that were already in the guide or concepts that I wanted to explore. And then later, if I wanted to really focus on that thing and I thought, well, what do I need to look at in order to get more information about this? All those resources would already be listed and ready and waiting for me to go exploring later if I wanted to.
I think it's really handy for people who want to, like you said, mouse over, like nose around, like, you know, digging. You mentioned the analogy of the elephant, the blind people trying to feel this beast, you know, feel their way to this, like, what is this thing? And we're all trying to do that with different approaches of spirituality or psychology. Can you explain what you mean by integrated linear resources, that you've integrated linear resources into one nonlinear web to form insights that otherwise you would never have? Can you give an example of that?
Oh, absolutely. So this was something that I didn't even expect to happen. It just did as I was building this. The real benefit of Obsidian, there are many, so I'll just say one benefit of Obsidian, is that you can have an individual page for something as broad as like Greco-Roman history or something as specific as the definition of a word, which means you can get as macro or as micro as you need to. That granularity ends up giving you a lot of information that you wouldn't necessarily have thought of. It's like a meta-analysis kind of level of information. And so whenever I was writing one thing or another, it would be really easy to be like, oh, this is reminding me of something else. And then I would just link that page. And sometimes I would just forget about it. But then other times I would just see it sitting there. Or I would be reading, you know, a page out of a book that was about some other modality, some other idea, some other practice. And then I would see something in it that was like, I wrote something not unlike this just a few days ago. And so I would compare those two things and I'm like, oh, this is like, it was that feeling the elephant situation, where it was like these two people were talking about the same thing and had no idea. And they were approaching it from two different angles. And so that let me sort of, I don't want to say like synergize, but sometimes it would just give me this aha moment, be like, of course this thing works a little bit like this. And it allowed me to sort of combine them, or even to just give me a new I know this is an IFS term, but a trailhead to follow to just see what would emerge from that. And so every now and then, actually, I would say this happens often, is that by just swimming around in this stuff that I've made, they would just stand out at me. It's hard to put into words because it's not something I did intentionally. It's something that emerges during the process. It's not any kind of strategy that I have. It's just something that happens. And I've seen that same thing happen to a lot of people who use Obsidian for their own purposes, is that they end up learning from their own material just because there are interconnections between things that they otherwise would never have seen. It's frankly fascinating. And there's, you know, there's the list of links that are at the bottom of most pages that show, here are all the pages that link to this one. But in Obsidian, there's even a way that you can see what pages haven't been linked, but the words that you've assigned to those pages are somewhere in the one that you're looking at. And so you can actually look down that list and see, oh, there's actually some stuff here I've written about before, but I completely forgot about it. And now it's given me another reason to just add to that puzzle and to just see more of it. It's more facets of that jewel, you might say.
That is fascinating. Who has the guide helped?
Oh, boy.
How do you know? Do people reach out and share with you what it means to them?
So there's been a real sort of like a hodgepodge of people who've reached out to me about this. And the first time I published it, or when I initially published it, I shared it to a Reddit community that was dedicated to sharing trauma resources. And I just put it there. I was like, it's not finished. I don't know if it'll ever be. I've got problems with it. There are dead ends and some stuff is kind of messy, but it functions and maybe it would help someone right now. So here it is. And within a few hours, it was like the second or third most upvoted post in its history. So I got a huge influx of emails, messages, comments within the first few weeks. They just kept coming in and coming in. And that was when it was first published. So there was a combination of just like people saying these jaw-droppingly sweet things that would just have me crying. And then there was some panic too, because of what it might mean for, you know, having suddenly a spotlight on me that I didn't want. I'm grateful that people responded the way they did, but I wasn't anticipating the emotional reaction I would have to their reaction to it. But then there are lay people who are just psychologically curious. There are people in trauma recovery communities. There's people in the IFS community. There are yoga teachers, coaches, IFS therapists who are following it. Clients are sharing it with their therapists, therapists are sharing it with their clients. And I'm aware that there are actually multiple trauma recovery communities, including ones that are grounded in IFS, that name the guide as one of their main resources that they encourage people to use in order to navigate their interiority. So it's been a wide variety of responses, but of course, most people have said nothing. Most people, you know, they read and they move on. They might respond to it in a way, but it takes a lot for somebody to reach out to another person, especially someone whose face they've never seen. And, you know, there's all sorts of parts that can be up and about, you know, not wanting to be super vulnerable. And just so most people haven't reached out. I don't know how many totally people have looked at it, but I know every month it gets somewhere in the ballpark of 16,000 to 18,000 unique readers. I don't check those numbers anymore because it was kind of driving me crazy a little bit for a while. But yeah, I know there's a wide variety of people, but I don't know much about them, which is kind of sweet. I just know they're all over the world.
That's pretty awesome. I'm going to jump back to talk about, you know, money, because when I was studying theology in undergrad, I did not know I was going to go into psychology and social work. Thought I was going to go into some kind of church ministry, and then really took a 90-degree turn and really focused on secular forms of healing, secular spirituality. And but one of the people that I read about and followed in the Christian tradition, spiritual tradition, was Saint Francis of Assisi. And he's a guy who, according to the history and the stories, was pretty wealthy, had a lot of inheritance. And he gave away all of it, and he ended up being homeless and not having clothes. So a lot of the attributes to Saint Francis of Assisi, and of course the Pope is named Francis. I was not Catholic, but a lot of these institutions that are named after Saint Francis are usually working with the poor and giving people services in some way. On the other hand, money is a tool, and money can amplify something really good. It can poison something really good as well. But would you ever consider, is there like a point at which, like, you know, the desire to stay free actually begins hurting because it's not, you're not causing harm directly, but like it's not helping as many people as it could if you were devoting, like if this was paying for your, to make a living?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I can tell you that I noticed money poisoning it before it helped.
Well, how was that?
When I first published it, the mind state that I was in, I hesitate to use the word, but it is the one that most fits, is I had an enlightenment experience before I published it. And as life started to do life things and suddenly I needed to find funding in order to just live, more and more protectors wanted to run the show. And one thing that I noticed is that if you want to activate somebody's protectors, put a problem in front of them. And suddenly I had a huge number of problems, and all of them would have been solved by money. Almost all of them. And so there was, and still is, a real tension between how much do I want to adhere to this. I almost want to call it a rule, but it's more of a principle that this kind of resource ought to be free. And how much do I want to acknowledge that I live in the world that I live in and I need to take care of myself, and I could be doing that more. So part of it is that after it was published and I was holding that question, I got to a point where I was having to make that decision every day, because I knew that with the kind of attention the guide was getting already and the kind that it could get if I put more effort into getting it out there, because I haven't put a lot of effort into getting more eyes on it, it could potentially make me a lot of money in a very short time. And I knew that. And one of the feelings I had was that part of making the world that I would want to live in would probably include having the opportunity to make a lot of money and not taking it. Not because I want to be, you know, to not have that money, but because this needs to be more publicly available. And the fact is, I don't know of another resource like it, and I don't know any other way to demonstrate, you know, the value of the people who are seeing it besides just leaving it there. Because I was at a, when the guide was first published, I was at a point where I was trying to make the decision to whether I would put some sort of paywall in front of it. It was before I really, you know, showed it to anybody. I was making that choice. And I thought, actually it was more, it wasn't a thought, it was a feeling. It was a visceral, embodied no, because I knew that if such a resource existed, I wouldn't have been able to pay for it. I was not in a position to where I could have done that. And even if I could have, I don't know how to price this because it didn't exist before. I don't know what it's worth, what it's not worth, how much to charge for it or not charge for
it. You do accept donations, but you make a point of saying you're not, that people don't owe you anything.
Right. That's part of why money can be so poisonous, is because it really easily turns something into a transactional relationship. There might be parts of me who are like, okay, now that I'm taking donations, I'm expecting donations. And if I'm not getting so much within so much time, that part might start to get bitter. Look what I'm putting out into the world, and I'm not getting much out of it. And that's making it more difficult for me to support myself, to take care of myself even. And so that was a real, and still is a significant challenge. So it's more of just, I've promised myself to do what I can to keep it free for as long as I possibly can. There's this sense of, it seems like a moral wrong in a way for it to be behind a paywall of any kind. And so it might change one day, but I don't have any intention of putting a paywall on it right now. It's not even on my mind.
There's a guy that I started listening to, love his podcast. Somebody I was working with turned me on to him. His name is Cal Newport. He's a computer science. Are you familiar with him? Yeah. So his podcast is called Deep Work, I believe, or something like that. He's written a book called Deep Work or Deep Thinking, and it's about slow work and, you know, not being on the hamster wheel, basically, and developing skills that are valuable and rare so that you can charge what you deserve to get in order to have the life that doesn't kill you. in other words, work for yourself, not for work. So I'm learning a lot from Cal Newport and some of the other guests that he's had on that talk about this idea of productivity and the myth of productivity in our capitalistic culture, which is like, if you're not doing something, mm-hmm. you're not productive.
Right.
So I wonder how that...
And if you're not productive, you don't deserve to live.
Yeah. Like, right? I mean, I feel like guys have wrestled with that more, generally speaking. Everyone wrestles with that, right? But yeah, mm-hmm. that's huge. If you don't have something that's valuable to others, like, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, fighting that mythology.
Yeah, and that's something that I've wrestled with for a long time and I'm still playing with at this point more than wrestling with it. You know, there are lots of books on productivity and how to, like, squeeze the most out of your time. But that's largely driven by this capitalistic, individualistic perspective. And so part of this is just like the discovery of what I've been calling effortless value, and this might exist in other frameworks already. I wouldn't call it a framework, but whenever I was at rock bottom to the point that I genuinely believed I had nothing to offer anyone, to the point that I thought, well, I don't want anyone to ask me for anything because I don't have anything. I need help. All I can do is take right now. I would show up in certain communities and just talk, just like telling the truth about what was going on with me. People just started reaching out to me and saying how helpful it was, how valuable it was. And that was genuinely confusing for me. I don't understand how I can be helping people without trying to help people. That doesn't make sense. And so that had me this aha moment of just like, oh, this is what it means to be worthy exactly as you are. Because the fact is, you don't actually need to effort in order to be valuable to some people, because you can just show up and you will be valuable to them because you're you. And even now there are parts of me that struggle with that possibility. And the productivity piece, there's a book that I haven't read, but from what I've heard from it, it falls well in line with my own discoveries as I was working on the guide and during that experience I had, which is that productivity is largely a trap. It's a book called 4,000 Weeks. I can't remember who wrote it. But one of the pieces of it that I love the most, and that might be just because it's something that's especially relevant to me, is this idea of the efficiency trap. Which is that you get the idea that you make your productivity systems hyper efficient so that you can have more time to do what you'd rather be doing, to rest, to take care of your family and those things. But what actually happens is whenever you get all these things super efficient, you end up just adding more to your plate. And so you end up just as stressed out as you were before. And I think that's in large part because, including myself, we have parts who are just like, no, we need to be this busy. We need to be this stressed out because this is how you demonstrate that you're really doing something.
Time management for mortals, Oliver Berkman.
Yeah, that's the
4,000 Weeks.
Excellent book.
Tim Ferriss, I think, is the guy who said, you know, if you're, you know, this applies for people who are very successful and have reached this sort of like almost 1% or I don't know what, upper 10% of value into society economically. He's like, if you need to hire a personal assistant, you are working way too much. Like, that's a sign that you should work less, not hire a personal assistant. Like, if you can't go to the grocery store, if you can't do your laundry, like, And speaking of laundry, you mentioned, I was really stunned to see this, like right next to, I forget what it's next to. It's like next to Tara Brach and equanimity or mindfulness is like how to do laundry. can you help me understand the relevance?
Yeah. So not everything in the guide was written within the context that the guide was published in. Some stuff, it was just like things that I wanted to know and wanted to like simplify for myself and just have it on hand. What it was on my phone in my pocket. But I published it to the guide specifically because, again, we're talking about people who have been through some of the worst of the worst. There are people who don't know how to do laundry. That I've seen those questions. There are people who don't know how to do like basic household stuff. And so part of what trauma recovery is for a substantial number of people is just learning life skills that we didn't have people in our lives to teach us. So I just left it there.
Well, it's good for my kids because they could learn something about that. You know, the discussion about capitalizing on a good that is for healing purposes or medicinal purposes, like clearly we have this huge industrial complex, big pharma, which has done a lot of good, right? It is organized and pooled money and resources to tackle some really complex, difficult things that might not be tackled if there wasn't a big pot, a big reward. On the other hand, things that are kind of like still extremely devastating for people, but not really that profitable, get ignored. And if you can't make a huge profit from it, then those things get ignored. And interestingly, psychedelics fall into that category. These are drugs that increasingly pharmaceutical companies are working. Like I run a ketamine clinic, and I know there are pharmaceutical companies trying to modify, they've already modified the ketamine molecule, which is used in general anesthesia and can be used for the treatment of severe depression. They're modifying it to take away the psychedelic effects, to make it sub-psychedelic. And they're trying to make psychedelics more accessible on the one hand, which I think is interesting. I mean, it's a big debate whether the subjective hallucinations and the so-called trip is actually instrumental to the tremendous healing benefit that we've seen in the research. A lot of scientists say, no, it's not. It's really just exposing your brain to this substance, and the neuroplasticity comes from that. It's not, it's great if you meet Jesus in your, you know, floating above the beltway during your trip, but it's actually not necessary to heal from PTSD or depression. My point with that was I've been in some rooms with people and have, you know, raised my hand or gone around the room and said, you know, I work as I'm here for personal reasons, right? That's why I've gotten interested in psychedelic medicine. But I'm also professional, and some of the conversation around commercializing, I sometimes think there are darts thrown at professionals that I'm like, wait, go, I mean, easy, right? Like, you know, some of these things we can work together. You know, there's ways, there's good people in commercial enterprises that are really doing good.
Yeah. So one point, just to rewind a little bit, I neglected to mention, because we were talking about funding earlier and like versus self-care. If I had even everyone who's reading the guide donate $1 a month, the guide would be self-sustaining.
Oh, wow.
And if I had money to play with, the guide would be a lot more robust in a lot shorter time than it is right now. Like, I built what's there right now with an e-reader and my laptop, with otherwise very few resources, like economic resources. I have ideas that I can't implement because I don't have the funding for it. So if I had that, it would be much more robust. And so that's also on my mind.
Well, hopefully people are listening and this might have some effect, right?
But the other piece of it, like this feeling of, I mean, like I said, there is anger involved in the guide's creation, and there's anger around the situation that we collectively are in. And I think one of the ways that it can manifest is being angry at professionals, especially when we see, here's how much I charge by the hour. It's really easy to feel that way. And now I kind of am that way because I have clients myself. And so I have a sliding scale where you can, you know, pay as much as you can that is actually sustainable for you. But otherwise, here's the least that I'll take that I'm able to. It took me months to decide whether I was even going to put my practice in the guide at all. For that reason, there were parts of me who felt hypocritical for doing that. At the same time, I've met a lot of professionals now, and a lot of them are like what you described. They got into it so that they could help themselves first. And so it makes a lot of sense to me for people who are actually just people generally to be angry at professionals, because there are a lot of people in it who present in such a way that when you see them, it's like you can see, you might call them their self-like parts. Like those are the ones who are front and center. They're leaning heavily into marketing. They're leaning heavily into their credentials. They smile at you and you kind of feel like they're lying to you already. And I have parts who are very, very sensitive to that. Something I'm working on. But a big thing that I've noticed as I've gotten to know like people who are at least somewhat well off and people who are highly paid professionals, they also have these problems and they are trying to do something to make sense of it, trying to do something to alleviate some of them somehow. They might be doing work that we know nothing about because they might be somewhat like me and they just don't want their name on it. I don't know what that looks like, but I've heard from different people who are doing, you know, some form of what you might call volunteer work. But another piece of it is just a lot of them don't know what to do because they had to take on huge amounts of debt in order to get the credentials they have, like hundreds of thousands of dollars that aren't paid off. And now we're living in the age of BetterHelp that'll say like, oh, you can, you know, spend $40 to $60 on a therapist. But one, that's very low for a therapist because doing that kind of work, I mean, I'm not a therapist, but the work that I do with clients is similar enough that they're comparable. There's a lot of overlap between the two. If I were to do that for 8 hours a day, I would be burned out quickly in almost no time. It's highly empathetic, highly concentrated, highly skilled. It takes a lot out of you. I'm happy to give that. But if I had to do that for as long as I would be doing like a normal shift of a regular job, I would be spent in a very short time and useless.
Totally. And that's what the insurance companies do with practices that are just based on insurance. They're kind of mills because those therapists have to be seeing almost 40 hours a week, 30 to 40 to be making a living, which in Washington, D.C. is like $150,000 a year. And yeah, it's not a lot. BetterHelp actually changed. I think BetterHelp and some of the other ones that are out there changed the game. Like before the pandemic, Levi, you know, I had, I think 14 or 15 therapists in my practice and people wanted to affiliate and have that community as a practice. And since then, and I'm not the only one, I like half a dozen colleagues of mine who own practices haven't been able to hire since then. Literally, I've stopped, aside from starting the ketamine psychedelic group. And that's, you know, one reason why we did, because we're like, look, this is, the market has completely shifted. People are saying like, I'm not going to work, period. First of all, there was that going on. And then second of all, it's like, I'm not going to work for you. I'm going to do this myself. Even though I just came out of grad school, I'm going to start my own practice. And we never saw that before. So it's really changed the game. What about psychedelics? I'm curious if that's in the guide, and you know, what are some topics? Is that one of them that you'd like to write more about in the guide?
Oh, absolutely. So you know, earlier I mentioned this sort of enlightenment experience that I had. I'm not there right now, by the way, just to make that perfectly clear. I at the time I was going through it, I didn't know that was even what was happening.
Shit.
I hadn't heard it described.
I thought
before.
You were enlightened. I thought I was speaking. I thought at this very moment you were enlightened.
I am in fact on a chair and not floating through the air.
This interview is over.
Yeah. But I didn't have the language for it. I didn't know what was happening, which means I definitely didn't have anyone in my life who could help me stabilize it. But the reason I bring that up is because a part of the fascination that I think a lot of us have with psychedelics is that people who have been having an intense meditation practice for a very, very long time can get into mind states that are identical to what some psychedelics put us into. So that was one thing that made me extremely interested in this. The other piece of it was just that, you know, having, you know, what you might call complex PTSD, I was trying to find anything that I could to try and help myself because I was in excruciating pain that I didn't think I would survive. And so the first glimmer of hope, I would say it was more of a glimmer, was the discovery of psychedelic medicine. And so I started reading, I think the first book I grabbed was Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind. And that was one of the first books I had read that gave me significant hope, where I did nothing but read that book until it was finished. And I loved that book. But yeah, it's something that I am keenly interested in, especially since IFS and other versions of parts work. And then what I'm doing with Alethea, which includes parts work, ends up getting people into a state that's very similar to a psychedelic experience. And I have clients who they've done psychedelics and maybe even psychedelic therapy. And they're like, this feels very similar. Like you're on the border between those states sometimes, and you might even tip over into the other one a little bit. So I haven't written a huge amount on psychedelics. There's some stuff there, mostly resources. And that's in large part because, especially around, you know, what psychedelics can do or microdosing, we're still in a state of flux right now. And so I would have to be constantly updating it all the time if I were keeping up with it, you know, diligently. So I just haven't. And two, there were some ethical concerns around, you know, and even like legal concerns about, you know, I didn't want so many eyes on me at one time, especially about those particular things. But I have had some experience with just a psychedelic experience, because you could argue, not argue, I would say that this is actually true. The sort of catastrophic breakdown that eventually catalyzed the guide's creation was a drug-free psychedelic trip. It had all the same components. I've described it to people. They're just like, yeah, that's exactly what that sounds like. Or I would read stories of what a psychedelic experience was like at like a therapeutic dose. And I'm like, yep, that's what happened. And so I have zero doubt whatsoever that I've gone way, way, way deep. Just without the drugs. So I wanted to get into psychedelics, not like necessarily as a practitioner, though maybe one day, but just delving into those because it was like, well, maybe you could do the same thing, but in a much safer container than what I did. Not that I did it on purpose. I didn't, but it was, yeah.
I mean, it's one of the reasons why IFS, internal family systems and parts work, the idea that we have multiple personalities, that we are composed of sub-personalities, makes so much sense with psychedelics, because these altered states, what do you do with that material, right? If you think your mind is unitary and you have a psychedelic trip, well, you're in for a surprise, because you'll see some things you didn't think existed inside of you, that you realize are actually core truth. I want to get to Stephen Porges SSP, because my last episode covered psychoacoustics. And I'm actually enrolled starting next week in a, well, as people listen to this, it'll be like I've already taken a few weeks of this course with Paula Scatoloni. And she's a SSP practitioner. And I'm doing it for my own purposes, because I heard what she had to say about it. And I looked into it, retraining the inner ear muscles from a trauma state, a defensive state, to an open, relaxed state. Can have extremely powerful physiological effects, to the point where people are writing on Reddit that, you know, if you're not careful, you end up really messed up. You end up like nauseous and with tinnitus and stuff going on in your body that you know, move stuff around. Just like psychedelics, we say like go low and go slow. Do you have any thoughts about that? I know we just have a few minutes left. Any thoughts about that particular topic, or want to refer people to a place on the guide?
Well, I haven't delved into that very much, though. The thing that comes up for me is, like earlier when you brought up Porges, it was around models and therapeutic modalities, and basically we're patenting different models of psychology. that causes more problems than it solves. Because if we are patenting these models, then we can't meld them. We can't play with them. It's this idea that I've figured everything out and this is the thing you need. But there's actually significant overlap between all of these things. More often than not, it's actually not terribly new, but that's actually a good thing because it means that we're making the same discoveries over and over again. That's a form of verification that there's something true about what we're saying. And having this sort of like competition between one modality and another means that there are entire pieces of the puzzle that we're excluding or walling off from ourselves. And that the only thing that does is it hurts practitioners who are just trying to learn this stuff in the first place and being pinballed around from one thing to another, trying to make sense of it. And then it hurts the people who actually need it because it pits everyone against each other. That's not confusing. A cooperative thing.
It's confusing. Yeah. I don't know if I shared this with you or if you knew this, but in 2015, I wrote a book called How to Save Your Marriage and Survive Couples Counseling. And because I was a couples counselor and I just realized that people are coming in like so confused and they don't even have a clue when I tell them, you know, what to expect. They don't have a clue to how to discern that from what someone else might offer or why we're doing this instead of that. And so the big three models of couples counseling, at least I just picked the three big ones to me, the Gottmans, Imago, you know, Harville Hendricks, and Sue Johnson, emotionally focused couples therapy. And I would show up at, you know, their workshops and say, hey, I'm writing this book. I'm including all your, you know, trying to integrate you, Harville Hendricks, with John Gottman. And like, actually, Harville's amazing. I think he's out of the bunch. He's very open to integration and very open to like collective use of his work and just wants it to proliferate, which I appreciated. But I didn't get that vibe from everybody. And so I was like, well, I'm just going to write it this way. I'm going to say, look, you're saying the same thing. And just, you know, buyer beware, like this is what you're getting. You need to educate yourself.
There's some, like generally, I like to believe that a lot of this replication stuff has gone on mostly accidental, but it does seem like there are people who just, they want it to have their name on it. They want it to be distinct from all these other things. Sure. They don't want you to point out how they overlap because that would sort of break the proprietary model that they've built. And that causes significant harm.
Yeah. I think your message is one that really needs to be said. I hope you continue to grow the Integral Guide and have a platform. You have an amazing voice. Like, I think you're speaking for something that is legitimate and powerful and something that needs to be said. And like, I'm coming to you as a person in one of those power structures. Admittedly, like, I'm not giving that up because it's like, I don't want to say it's too late. But maybe you can influence me and bring me back to the other side where I started out as a social worker. It's hard. You know, we only have one son.
One of
our kids got admitted to college and he's going to his top choice school and it's amazing. Mm-hmm. But holy shit, it's like 90 grand a year. Like, right. You know, so I'm not trying to get sympathy from people. I'm just making a point that it's there's real world pressures once you take on stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually an important point to make is that when I say that this problem is systemic, I really mean it. Like, there's no one person to blame. Yeah. There's no point in blaming anyone. It makes sense from like a parts perspective where there are parts who would like hold a lot of bitterness, a lot of resentment. That makes sense. I can validate that. It makes all the sense in the world. And yet it's sort of like one protector blaming another. Or it's just like, you don't know the job that they're doing right now if you're blaming them.
Well, I don't want to keep you much longer. I know you have to jump on a meeting. Any final thoughts, anything that you'd like to share with people that you'd like to put out there or something currently or about to drop that you'd like to share?
Sure. Well, for one, I hope anyone who hasn't seen the guide already does go look at it. I mean, it is completely free. There's nothing that asks for your credit card information. There's no sign up. There's no data collection or anything like that. It's just there and waiting for you right now. Please do share it with people if you find that it's useful, because like I said before, I don't put a ton of effort into putting it in front of people specifically because if it's shared by word of mouth, it tells me that it's actually helping. And I don't advertise at all. I do have other things going on. They're not still cooking, but I'm sort of opening up to showing more of me because I haven't done that very much. And there have been a lot of questions about that and even, frankly, things that I want to do. And so if you end up subscribing to my newsletter or just hanging out on the guide, eventually you'll see some of that, assuming, like, maybe it's already out by now by the time this is published. I don't know. But yeah, I would be really interested to know how it impacts you, if it does. Because if people don't tell me, then I don't know. And I really enjoy hearing from people.
Well, your guide is called integralguide.com, I-N-T-E-G-R-A-L, guide.com. I hope people check it out and get back in touch with you. Thanks so much for your time, Levi.
Yeah, thank you, Keith. It's good to see you.